Shots, shots, shots. Bubbles in the beer. Pain in our body. Anxiety in our brain. Today's guest is William Porter, the author of Alcohol Explained. We are going to talk all about the physiological and mental effects of alcohol, why we drink it, what it does to us, and how by removing it from our lives, everything can get much, much better. The following is my conversation with William Porter. William, great to have you on here. I'm going to start with some really, really broad questions just to kind of get things rolling. First, I want to ask, what is drunkenness exactly? We all know, like a lot of us know from our conscious experience, we know the subjective experience of what it is to be. And drunkenness is sort of a spectrum, right? It starts with like kind of this relaxed feeling, and then maybe you're a little tipsy, then maybe you're drunk, and then you're just totally trashed, and then maybe you're blackout drunk. You don't need to go through the entire spectrum because it basically different things are happening in the brain, in the body throughout this process. And it might be hard to even explain all that, but give us a kind of overview of what is sort of happening in the brain through that night of drinking.
So alcohol, it's a drug, it's a sedative, a depressant. So when I use the word depressant, I'm using it in its chemical sense as something that decreases or inhibits nerve activity. So it's like an anesthetic. It sedates you, makes you sleepy, makes you feel more relaxed if you're feeling uptight. But of course, as you take more and more of it, you become intoxicated. So your speech slurs, your reactions slow down massively. You can become very disorientated. How it usually works is because alcohol is a sedative, but your brain creates and excretes a huge array of its own chemicals, drugs, and hormones. You know, things you've heard of, such as adrenaline, cortisol, which is a stress hormone, dopamines, endorphins, all of these things, your brain creates and excretes it. And it's a massively complicated process that we don't fully understand. But what we do know is it works by something called homeostasis, which is basically a chemical, it's a balancing act of all these different chemicals, drugs, and hormones. So your brain's trying to keep this balance. So if you introduce something like alcohol, which is a sedative, your brain it senses that there's been a disturbance to that homeostasis, that delicate balance, and it takes steps to try and correct the balance. So it releases adrenaline and cortisol. Again, I've talked about it. It's a stress hormone. And what your brain's trying to do is counter the sedating effects of the alcohol. And it's a completely natural and healthy reaction. And it's how your brain strives to keep working even when you take this external drug that messes with its chemical balance. But the problem is when the alcohol wears off, when it's metabolized and removed from your system, that oversensitization, the cortisol, the adrenaline is all left over. So you feel really uptight and unpleasant. So the easiest way of thinking about it, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Okay. So whatever relaxing or sedating effect you get from a drink, there's a corresponding feeling of uptightness or anxiety when it wears off. Right. So there's two ways of getting rid of that unpleasant feeling. One is to wait a few days until your brain chemistry gets back to normal. But the far quicker way of getting rid of it is to have another drink. Because the reason you feel unpleasant and uptight and anxious is because your brain's geared up to work under the sedating effects of the alcohol, but there is no alcohol. So if you reintroduce alcohol, you have another drink, you immediately feel much better. So this is why after you've been drinking a few years, a lot of people say, I don't have an off switch. What they mean is, you know, when you start drinking, it's very hard to stop. And the reason for that is the brain starts to realize that unpleasant feeling that kicks in when one drink wears off can be replaced with another drink. So when you start drinking, you're kind of committed to an ongoing process until you fall unconscious. Now, you know, you've mentioned relaxation, you've mentioned intoxication, and we often think of it as part and parcel of the same process. But actually, those two parts of drinking have different timescales attached to them. So the relaxation wears off far quicker than the intoxication wears off. So just to give an example, say you go to a party, your friends are there, you're feeling a bit nervous, you want a couple of drinks. You have a couple of drinks and that makes you feel relaxed and a bit more comfortable. At that moment, you're two drinks relaxed and two drinks intoxicated, right? There's not much to it. Within a very short space of time, the relaxation as feeling is gone and it's being replaced by that anxious, unpleasant feeling. But the intoxication hasn't worn off. So you have another couple of drinks to chase away that unpleasant feeling and to keep that what we think of as the alcohol buzz, that nice relaxed feeling. But then you're two drinks relaxed still, but four drinks intoxicated because the intoxication hasn't worn off. And as you're continually chasing that feeling of relaxation, you're becoming increasingly intoxicated. And that's why over time it becomes increasingly difficult to like moderate or to keep track of what you're drinking, because each drink causes a desire for the next one. And as you have that next drink, you become more and more drunk.
Yeah, this kind of explains also, because you're talking about homeostasis, this process of going from one extreme to the other follows into the following day and it follows throughout our lives basically.
Yeah.
So yeah, maybe you're really extra relaxed or you got too much GABA or whatever in your brain and your body, it's like, oh, this is too much. Let's go the other direction. So then it turns on almost the alcohol becomes almost like a stimulant, it seems like, and you're really excited. But then you get so high, especially if you drink too much. And then the following day, it goes back to overcorrect or something. So yeah, what is a hangover?
Well, that's basically what it is. I mean, there's the nausea. So you can actually feel sick and headachey. But for most people, the worst part, there's two parts of the hangover that are the worst parts. One is that because of that chemical imbalance that's created, alcohol completely ruins your ability to sleep. So we quite often in our society, we have a very deeply held belief that alcohol assists sleep. But it doesn't. A lot of people think, you know, you just go to bed, lie your head on a pillow, go unconscious for a few hours and you get up and you're good to go. But it's not remotely as simple as that, unfortunately. When you sleep, you go through very specific sleep cycles. There's a lot we humans don't understand about these sleep cycles yet, but what we do know is one of the main differentiating factors between the sleep cycles is how deeply unconscious you are. So you've got something called deep sleep, whereas you'd expect you're very deeply unconscious, but right on the other end of the scale, there's REM sleep. Now, REM sleep stands for rapid eye movement. And the reason it's called that is because when you go into REM sleep, your eyes flicker, even though your eyes are shut. When they monitor people in REM sleep, their brain lights up almost as if they're fully awake. It's when we dream in REM sleep. So it's this really unusual sleep cycle where you're almost fully awake, but not quite. You're dreaming, you're very active in your mind while your dreams are played out. And it's crucial. It's crucial for your physical and mental health. They've done tests on rats where they've starved them of REM sleep and they've been dead within a few weeks. They do human studies where you go in, you sleep, they monitor you. And when you go into REM sleep, they wake you up. So they starve you of REM sleep. Within a very short space of time, people become very depressed, very disorientated. It has a huge impact on their mental health. Now, the problem with alcohol is, although it makes you unconscious, it doesn't allow you to go through your natural sleep cycles. And one of the sleep cycles that suffers the most is REM sleep, because don't forget, your brain has to light up almost as if it's fully awake, but it can't do that when you've taken this powerful sedative, which is alcohol. So when people drink alcohol, even one or two drinks, it really diminishes their ability to get into REM sleep. So what most people find with a hangover, the worst parts of it are not always the headache and the sickness, although that can be quite debilitating. It's the fact that they haven't slept properly. So they've been, you know, they might have been in bed for 8 or 10 hours, but they haven't gone through the proper sleep cycle. So they always wake up tired. And the other part of it is, as we've discussed, that anxiety feeling. So most people, when they wake up having drunk, they feel very tired, but also extremely anxious and jittery at the same time.
Yeah, this all makes sense too, because one, you're losing the deep sleep, obviously, because you're out probably outside drinking and stuff at that time. There's not enough time to get the deep sleep. And then the REM sleep, which from what I understand is we're kind of living out our memories and our things that we had throughout our day. They might have been stressful things. They might have been important things. It might have been things we were learning in school or whatever. Normally, in our normal waking life, we have adrenaline and cortisol and all these things flooding through our veins, our body, as we're experiencing these things. But in REM sleep, maybe I'm wrong here, but the adrenaline is basically gone, And you're basically able to experience these things, could be traumas or could be something you need to kind of sort through, but without the emotional attachment to it. And so if we wake up, and I've noticed this when I a couple nights ago, I didn't get enough sleep. I wasn't drinking, but I maybe had too much coffee or something, so I couldn't get enough sleep. Maybe there's some similarity there. But I felt anxious. I felt stressed. I felt bad. It's almost like a hangover. And So, yeah, it's not getting the sleep, but it's also not getting that sort of that nocturnal therapy or whatever that softens things.
Yeah, that's exactly right. As I say, there's a lot we humans don't understand about it. The way I think of it is, you know, you need food to survive, right? So you take food, you chew it up and you swallow it. That's not good enough, okay? Having chewed up food in your system doesn't do you any good at all. You've got to digest it. You know, the digestive juices have got to break it down. It's got to be extracted and go into your body. Throughout the day, we experience things, okay? Every single day we experience stuff. When you go to sleep, REM sleep is when your brain takes all those experiences and breaks them down and digests it, literally comes to terms with it, sorts it all out. And what you're doing, you're stopping your body or your brain to have that ability to digest your experiences, essentially. Yeah. So that's exactly what it said. I mean, you described it perfectly, you know, that nocturnal therapy, that's exactly what it is. It's like your brain stopping for a minute, looking at everything that's happened, coming to terms with it, accepting it, all the rest of it. That's why quite often if we get a good night's sleep, you know, if you've got an issue, you know, problem or something you can't work out, quite often a good night's sleep is what you need to wake up in the morning and think, oh, right, I've got the answer to it, or, you know, I've come to terms with it, or just feeling better about it generally.
Yeah, but like the same thing happens going back to the homeostasis thing. You know, I had that bad night of sleep the other night, but then the following night I had amazing nighttime therapy. I was just dreaming, and I was almost like I was having conversations with, I don't know who, but working things out, and I woke up really fresh this morning. So yeah, alcohol is going to destroy us, but as long as we, you know, stop drinking or take some nights off or whatever, it seems like we might be okay. What are your thoughts on, like, is there a way to live life with alcohol? Or
so my personal opinion is, yeah, you can live life with alcohol, but in my view and in my experience, it's not as good as life as without alcohol. So you know you might say to yourself, okay, I'll just drink once or twice a week. Now, I was never a regular. There were periods when I drank every day, but they were unusual. My normal drinking habit was just at the weekends. And I knew alcohol wasn't good for me and I'd feel a bit rubbish the next day. But what I thought was, I drink Friday, Saturday, feel a bit rubbish Sunday, maybe even Monday, but, you know, Tuesday, Wednesday, I'm back to normal. What I only learned from stopping drinking is that what I considered normal and me at my best wasn't. And it wasn't until I stopped for a few weeks that I thought, oh my God, I feel, you know how different you feel when you're hungover and not hungover, you feel so much better. It was almost like that again, because with sleep is a habit, okay? If you go to bed at 11 o'clock and wake up at 7, but set your alarm for 3 o'clock in the morning for 5 nights, and then on the 6th night turn it off, you'll still wake up at 3 in the morning because that's the habit you're into. If you're ruining your sleep 2 days out of 5, you know, Friday, Saturday, you're completely demolishing your ability to sleep. It's probably going to take you 4 or 5 days to get back into a normal sleeping pattern. And then you need more time, another week or so, to actually start to catch up on that missed sleep. So you're almost saying to yourself, the less I drink, the less the ill effects will affect me. But I would say, why have the ill effects? Why not learn to live life without alcohol? And really, that's what I'm all about. It's trying to explain to people that, for me, it's almost like I envisage people in a prison, and each bar of the cage are the things that are keeping them drinking. Like, oh, but I enjoy it. It helps me relax. It helps me sleep. I can't imagine doing a vacation without drinking, or Christmas or Thanksgiving or family barbecues without alcohol. All these beliefs are the sort of the things that keep us in this cage. So I think, yeah, I mean, you absolutely can live life with alcohol, but in my experience, it's better not to have it. And like, for example, now, I mean, I could quite happily have a drink tonight if I wanted to, but then I'd feel probably a bit anxious and tired tomorrow.
I totally agree.
Why would I want to feel like that?
One thing you mentioned was we have these positive experiences like vacations and birthdays and holidays and things like that, and meeting certain people, going to certain places. And we often couple this experience with alcohol, and almost the two become enmeshed together. How do we, this is kind of a tough question, how did you kind of uncouple that positive experience of, you know, actual positive experience with the sort of fleeting positive experience of alcohol that ended up actually crashing you down?
Yeah, for me, it was understanding, it was delving in a bit to the psychology and physiology, really, of social occasions. So you've heard of endorphins, right? I'm sure all your listeners have heard of them as well. It's a drug that, one of the drugs that your brain naturally creates and excretes, and it makes you feel really good. So when your brain releases endorphins, you feel really good. Now, it releases them in certain situations. It's quite interesting. I always think of it as kind of like a survival of the species drug, because we get a boost of it when we do something either good for us or good for us as a species. So for example, if you're hungry and you have a healthy meal, you get an endorphin rush. If you do exercise, if you have sex, okay, you get an endorphin rush. One of the best ways to get an endorphin rush is to socialize, which I think is really interesting because it kind of shows how we as a species are meant to communicate to each other and how it helps us evolve and progress. But be that as it may, the thing to bear in mind is if you are relaxed and happily socializing with people, you will get an endorphin rush, okay? Your brain will release endorphins and you will start to feel really good. There's two points to note from that. Firstly, we tend to drink, or certainly when we start drinking, we tend to drink in social situations. So what we think of as an alcohol buzz, which is a really nice feeling, isn't actually alcohol. It's alcohol plus endorphins. And it's really interesting, but the bit that makes you feel really good isn't the alcohol, it's the endorphins. And if anyone's in any doubt about that, it's a very interesting experiment to say you go out and naturally have, I don't know, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 drinks, whatever, and you think, I have a really great time because I'm drinking. Have those however many drinks, sat at home, no TV, no music, no social media, nothing. Just sit in a quiet room and drink those drinks and see how it makes you feel. It doesn't make you feel good at all. It's a bit of a weird feeling. It makes you feel disorientated, a bit tunnel vision, but it's not actually pleasant. So that's the one thing to note that helped me get free. But the other thing was just to understand the dynamic a bit, because when, like I say, so when you're relaxed and socializing, you get this endorphin rush, right? But we humans are products of society, and most, not everyone, but most people are to a degree, suffer from a degree of social anxiety. So I'm quite bad with it. But when I turn up at a social event, I always feel quite nervous, quite self-conscious. I don't make small talk particularly easy. So I turn up feeling quite stressed, right? So that's the normal dynamic. For a greater or lesser degree, that's what it's like for most people. You enjoy social events, but when you turn up, you feel a bit nervous. Now, if you don't have alcohol, eventually you will relax a bit. You'll get chatting to someone. Hopefully you find them interesting. You'll forget that self-consciousness, all the rest of it, and you'll relax into the social event. And when that happens, you will get your endorphin buzz. Okay, that's the natural way of socializing. When you introduce alcohol to it, what happens is you turn up feeling nervous and a bit anxious. The alcohol, it is a sedative, so it does make you feel better. It does take the edge off that anxious feeling, so you get that endorphin buzz a bit quicker, okay? But what I learned was I didn't actually need it to socialize. And if anyone's in any doubt about that, most of us socialized as children without alcohol. You know, you go to a 10, 12-year-old's birthday party, they turn up really nervous and anxious, but give it half an hour, they're running around going absolutely berserk, having the best time ever. No one would suggest turning up at an 8-year-old's birthday party and giving them some beer to make them enjoy themselves more. It would be ridiculous. So, but the problem is when we start to introduce alcohol, we start to think we need it to enjoy ourselves, because our experience is I turn up at a social event, I don't feel particularly good, I have a couple of drinks and I really enjoy myself. We miss the fact that we would enjoy ourselves anyway. It just might take us a bit longer, but we didn't actually need alcohol in the first place. But the problem is then when you're, I don't know, not well on antibiotics, you're designated driver and you can't drink, you're turning up at the social event thinking, oh, I can't have a drink. So you don't relax and you don't enjoy yourself. So you don't get that endorphin rush. So because you're introducing alcohol, you suddenly find you can't get that endorphin rush without it. So our experience of social events is if I go and I'm not drinking, it's all right, but I don't really enjoy it. But when I have a drink, it's a really good night. So we kind of think the alcohol is adding something. But what I started to learn was it never did add anything. It just took away our ability to enjoy ourselves naturally without it.
And even if you think back on, recollect your favorite, your best memories of not just child, of course, childhood, you're not getting drunk, maybe when you're a teenager. But anyway, look at your best memories, your best social memories as an adult, at least for me, and I'm guessing for a lot of people, actually they weren't when they were drunk. It was you were just riding bicycles with your friend, or you were swimming across the lake, or you were chatting. I don't know what you're doing, but it was something much, much simpler and you weren't drinking. So that's one sort of anecdotal evidence that I think we all have that shows, whoa, maybe if the goal is to connect with other people and to get the endorphins and oxytocin and serotonin and all that we get from people, maybe alcohol, while it might give it to us a little bit in the very beginning, in the first couple of drinks, it's more what you're saying is the actual connection with the humans. And then this other point about that is even if it's the case that alcohol in the beginning does help us connect with each other and feel that those endorphins and serotonin and all that stuff, as the night goes on, and this is more true for depending on the individual, but in my case, for example, once I get pretty, I don't do it as much anymore because I've realized this isn't good. You start destroying relationships and becoming a social slob. Not only are you unattractive to be like you're, it might get worse. You might start getting angry or violent or crying or just. And this might go back to the whole not having the dreams, not having that emotional therapy. Maybe you need to release all these emotions elsewhere. Maybe better to have those bouts of violence and crying in your sleep. Crying is maybe a different thing. But yeah, my point is here is, not only do we have more positive experiences when we're not drinking, we also have some of our worst, terrible experiences with each other and with ourselves when we are, especially when you're drinking a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. I had this conversation with someone a few times, actually, because he always would say to me, but, you know, when I look back on my life, I had some really good times when I was drinking. And I always say, so did I. But I would have had good times if I hadn't been drinking. And it wasn't the drinking that made them good times. It was being out with my friends doing whatever. And if it was just due to the alcohol, I could just shut out the world and sit at home with a load of beer and just drink myself insensible all day, every day, and have the best time ever. Of course, it doesn't work like that. You have good times because you're doing something good, not because you're drinking alcohol. The thing you mentioned about, you know, people getting drunk and getting violent and crying and all the rest of it, the reason for that, this is quite an interesting one. So there's a part of your brain called the limbic system. I think it's at the front of your head here. And it deals with memory. But one of the other things it deals with is it regulates emotion. So how emotion is actually created and triggered in the brain. Your brain triggers an emotion and then the limbic system jumps in and kind of calms it down. So like if you're watching a sports game, for example, and you're losing and you're getting a bit irritated, anger or aggression might be generated, but the limbic system jumps in and sort of says, it's just a game, calm down, and you shrug it off and get on with your day. Now, I've already talked about how when you drink alcohol, there's two effects. There's a relaxing effect, but separately the intoxicating effect. The limbic system is particularly vulnerable to the intoxicating or anesthetizing effects of alcohol. So as you're drinking, that limbic system is increasingly anesthetized. And what that means practically is it stops being able to regulate your emotion. So when you're drinking, any emotion that is triggered just runs and runs and runs because your brain isn't there to jump, the limbic system isn't able to regulate it. So to go back to the sports example, if you're watching a game and your team's losing and you're getting annoyed, but you haven't been drinking, you can shrug it off and just walk away. If you've been watching the match and drinking away, that doesn't happen. Your limbic system can't do that. So you get angrier and angrier and angrier, and that's when all the violence kicks in. That's why there's that huge correlation between drinking and violent crime. It's because you can't regulate your emotions. And it's the same, you know, when people are drunk and they're crying or trying to message their exes and doing all that sort of stuff, all that nostalgia, whatever it is. It's all because your limbic system can't regulate your emotion. You quite often hear with people when they say, you know, when you do something drunk, it's what you want to really do sober, but the alcohol's removed all your inhibitions. It's complete rubbish. You're not doing or saying these things because you really want to do them and your inhibitions have been removed. You're doing those things because your brain's under the effect of a drug and it's not working properly. It's not the real you.
Yeah, that reminds me. I have a friend and he had a position open at his company. And at first he's like, hey, Mike, I think maybe you can get the job. He's just kind of saying that. But later on, as we're drinking, he's like, the reason I can't give you this job is look at you. You're out of control. I'm like, we only meet when we're drunk. So of course you're not going to hire a drunk guy and give him alcohol at work. I wouldn't hire the drunk me either. Yeah. Look at me when I'm not here. Okay, but fair enough. But it's like, it's interesting. I'm like, oh yeah. Okay. What are some of the long-term effects on the physiological level, particularly in the brain? You talked about how in the short term, it does cause this anxiety, this increase in cortisol, excitement, and all these other things, good and bad, a lot of bad. What are some of the long-term changes that happen in our body or brain?
So one of the most important ones, alcohol is a carcinogen. So the World Health, the medical branch of the World Health Organization, they class different compounds as carcinogens according to different categories. And they've, since 1980s, actually, it's been classed as a class one carcinogen along with cigarette smoking and asbestos. So it's highly carcinogenic. So long-term effects of drinking is an increased chance of getting cancer. The other thing it does sort of over the long term, and this is again how it affects the limbic system or the brain generally. So when you have a part of your brain which retains short-term memories and you have a different part of your brain that contains long-term memories. So you've got two different parts of your brain. The one that contains short-term memories is much smaller. It's got a much smaller capacity for memory than the part that is your long-term memory, as you would expect, because you're going to have more long-term memories by their very nature. They span your entire life than short-term memories. So how it works is during the day, there'll be stuff that gets almost, think of it as being downloaded to your short-term memory. And then when you sleep, it's put into your long-term memory. So an easy way to think about it is almost like you've got a laptop and a USB stick. You know, you can get small amounts on the USB stick, but lots and lots on the laptop, right? When you sleep, information is transferred from your short-term memory to your long-term memory. Now, the problem is, if you're drinking alcohol, you're not going through natural sleep processes. So that process of transferring from the short to the long-term memory either doesn't happen or doesn't happen properly, depending on how much you've been drinking. So you're not transferring memories from short to long-term. Now, the problem there is because the short-term memory, it's limited in what it can store, you start to overwrite stuff, okay? So if you've got a USB stick with limited data on it, you're trying to download loads and loads of stuff to it, eventually stuff gets overwritten. So that's what happens. So that's what blackouts are. You don't have to drink lots and lots to get a blackout. You just have to be drinking enough regularly enough to disturb your sleep. And that processing of information from the short to the long-term memory gets massively disrupted. So that's another of the sort of more long-term effects of drinking, those blackouts when people wake up and they can't remember whole days simply because there's been no transfer from short to long-term memory.
I remember you saying that you started drinking when you were, like a lot of us, I think you were 14 or 15 or something like that, right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And I don't know when you stopped, but what kind of caused you? It might have been some belief, some new knowledge you gained, or it might have been some terrible events that occurred. What kind of caused, or what series of events or pieces of knowledge or whatever helped to kind of spark that change for you?
Yeah, so for me, it was very much the latter. It was a rock bottom, I suppose you'd call it. Not as bad as many people's rock bottoms, but still sort of pretty low in the grand scheme of things, certainly for me. Because as I say, so I've been a a binge drinker. So I didn't used to drink during the week. Because I was a lawyer. I still am a lawyer. But you have to use your brain a lot. And I could never work when I was hungover. Even if I had one or two drinks, I would wake up a bit groggy and not really with it. And I really needed my brain to be top notch in order to be able to do my job. So I never used to drink during the week. I only used to drink at weekends. But what I used to find was, so I'd drink on a Friday and then I'd wake up at like 3 or 4 in the morning. Again, it's that chemical imbalance. You know, your brain's release a load of stimulants to counter the sating effects of the alcohol. The alcohol's worn off and you're suddenly wide awake. I quite often say to people, drinking alcohol is the equivalent. Say you need to sleep from 11 to 7 in the morning, 8 hours sleep. That's you at your best. Drinking alcohol is like setting an alarm for 3 or 4 in the morning and getting up and drinking 3 jugs of strong black coffee and lying there twitching and heart racing for the rest of the night. That's the effect it has. It's that overstimulation. So what I found was if I had a drink at night, it would help me get back to sleep. So I'd drink during the day and into the night, fall asleep, wake up 3 or 4 in the morning, get up and drink again, and then go back to sleep. Of course, when you do that, you kind of blur the lines between drinking, not drinking. So I'd wake up in the morning and drink again because it would help me feel better. And I literally would be drinking constantly through the weekend. And the problem is then come Sunday, you feel absolutely awful and sort of ringing sick, and then you're sat at home with nothing to do but keep drinking. So when I say I was a binge drinker, my binges would start like Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, even Tuesday, but constant drinking. And it was getting more and more out of hand. And then I came to after a particularly bad session. It was like mid-afternoon on a Saturday, and I'd been drunk for the best part of a week constantly. I hadn't been into work. My wife and kids had left the house. I was on the my home on my own. I just thought, I cannot keep doing this. I have to stop. So for me, it wasn't a sudden realizing a new bit of knowledge. It was just, I can't keep doing this. I have to stop. So that was the moment I stopped. And in fact, when I stopped, I didn't think it was going to be as good as it was. I was stopping thinking, I can't keep doing this, so I have to stop. But I'm giving up the one thing in my life that I really enjoy because it helps me deal with stress. I can't imagine going on holiday without drinking, or Christmas. All my social events revolve around alcohol, and I'll probably never enjoy a social event again. So my mindset at the time was, I can't keep doing this, but I'll never enjoy holidays, Christmas, social events, nothing. It's all going to be a washout now because I can't drink. And obviously experience proved the complete opposite. And then I sort of delved into why and how that was the case.
And just as we experience pain if we don't grab that next drink in our moment of pain, when our cortisol's shot up and our dopamine's plummeted and we want to fill it back up, we can expect that pain, so we grab the new drink or we don't. What can we expect if we just kind of stop drinking altogether in the first few days or week or whatever? I imagine there will be a bit of pain in the beginning.
Mm, yeah.
Or how was it for you?
It was deeply unpleasant the first day or two. I had drunk, as I say, I've been drinking for like the best part of a week straight and a lot. So I was in a very, very bad way. What I found was the first 24 hours, I mean, that first night, I just didn't sleep at all. I couldn't sleep. I was exhausted and in a very bad way, but I couldn't physically sleep because of that chemical imbalance. It was just too much. So I found the first 24 hours was awful. The following night, I managed to get some sleep, but still not much. And for that period, I could hardly eat as well. And it wasn't so much the nausea, but what we find is, depressants, when we relax, we eat, our appetite goes up. And when we're stressed, when we have like amphetamines or stimulants, it decreases our appetite. That might seem like counterintuitive, that alcohol, we've explained that alcohol is a sedative, but we talk of it as an appetite stimulant. But actually, the reason for that is digestion takes a lot of energy. When you eat food, the food has to go through something like 20 foot of digestive tract, and it's squeezed all the way by muscles. And that's why when you have a heavy meal or something, you feel very tired, because a lot of energy is diverted into eating. So your body is naturally set up to want to eat when you're relaxing and not when you're running around doing stuff, because it needs the energy for digestion. So what you'll find is the first couple of days, particularly if you've been drinking heavily, you'll be extremely anxious, you'll be unable to eat properly, and you'll probably find it incredibly hard to sleep. Now, when you pass through that period, you'll come out the other side and almost swing the other way, particularly if you've been drinking over a long period of time, you've not had proper sleep. So as you start to come out the other side of that, suddenly you can get enough sleep. So your body almost goes on a glut of sleep. So what you find is the first 2, 3, 4 days, you're anxious, you can't eat, you can't sleep properly. But then coming out the other side, you go the other way, you become incredibly hungry because your body's taken an awful knocking and it needs nutrition to try and repair itself. But also it goes on a complete binge of sleep to try and get enough sleep back under your belt. So you find you first eat, as I say, 3, 4 days feeling really anxious, and then it can be week, which a couple of weeks. The most I heard was 3 months of feeling tired and drained and just wanting to eat and sleep all the time. For most people, it's a week or two, for 3, 4 weeks maximum. The 3 month one was quite an extreme example. But then when that ends, it's almost like as quick as waking up one day and just thinking, oh wow, I feel different and good. And it suddenly hits you. And what you will feel then is basically how you will live the rest of your life, feeling really good. And I emphasize that for me, certainly it was better than any feeling of drinking. Even when you're having those first couple of drinks thinking it's such a good feeling, it's nothing compared to that waking up when you finally get back on an even keel, when your brain chemistry is back to normal and you've caught up on sleep and you're waking up feeling good.
So it sounds like the big thing is surviving that, those first few days or weeks or months or whatever. That's easily said. It's the same thing with nicotine. Maybe we'll talk about that a little bit later too. How do you survive? What did you do during that painful period to not go grab a drink?
So one of the things I think is probably worth talking about is what I call the craving cycle. So a lot of people think, you know, I want to quit alcohol, whatever, but I get cravings. People often think of cravings as things that are almost like bolt of lightning out of the sky. They're external to us, they happen and you can't do anything about it. A craving is a very specific conscious thought process. And what it is the thought of an alcohol, you know, you can crave anything. You can crave food, sex, nicotine, drugs, whatever. But let's stick to alcohol because that's specifically what we're talking about. So the thought of an alcoholic drink enters your head and you start fantasizing about it, thinking how it would be perfect and wonderful and how good you'd feel if you had a drink. And you start teasing yourself with the possibility of it. You start thinking, ooh, maybe I haven't picked the best day to quit drinking. I could quit tomorrow. I could just have a couple tonight. Or I've stopped for a few days now. Surely I can have one or two and just moderate. I don't have to quit completely. That's a bit extreme. Any kind of excuse to allow you to have just one more dose of your drug. Now, when you get into that thought process, it's really torturous. It's deeply unpleasant. It's something you desperately want. It's like being hungry and just sitting there staring at a pizza or whatever your favorite food is. It's in your mind and it's all you can think about. Now, the problem there is that kind of feeds into the addiction itself, because let's say, for example, you're out with your friends or you've had a bad day at work and you're just getting home to relax, or you're on holiday, you're on vacation, or it's Christmas, or you're out on a family barbecue, whatever that thing is, your definitive drinking situations, all of those situations are pleasant. Right? Being on vacation, you don't have to work, you don't have to cook, you don't have to clean. All you have to do is sit around all day and enjoy yourself, read books, swim in the pool, whatever it is. But those things are only enjoyable if you're paying attention to them, if you're engaged in them, if you're enjoying the fact that you're with your friends, you're relaxing after work, you're with your family barbecue or whatever. If instead of enjoying that situation, you're taken up in like an internal mental torture chamber about how you desperately want something that you can't have, you can't engage or enjoy any of those things, right? For most people, the quickest way to get rid of the craving is just to have a drink. because you're not going to crave something if it's already in your hands and you're drinking it. So the drink almost becomes a placebo at that point because, you know, you're on vacation, you can't enjoy what's going on because you're obsessing about alcohol. And all having that drink does is to release your brain from that unpleasant spiraling thought process so you can actually enjoy what's going on. So that's something I think people need to be aware of. Cravings are controllable. And really, the time to hit a craving is not when you're already craving, but it's when the thought first enters your head. What I did, I picked the thing I hated most about drinking, right? And for me, it was waking up 3-4 in the morning, anxious, heart beating, exhausted, but unable to go back to sleep, knowing I'd ruin the next day. Because even if, you know, I was already tired and exhausted, and the next day I wasn't even starting for another 4 hours, I used to hate that. So whenever I looked at an alcoholic drink, I would think to myself, if you have that, you will be waking up at 3-4 in the morning feeling awful. And that's what I started to associate with an alcoholic drink. So instead of looking at a cold beer and thinking, oh, that would be lovely, that will really hit the spot, I feel so good, I can, you know, all that nonsensical fantasy, I started to look at the reality. That beer equals lying in bed, anxious and exhausted and completely unable to sleep at 4 in the morning. And it kind of put me off it. And again, I, you know, some people might be listening to this thinking, oh, you're just trying to con yourself. But I wasn't, because for me, that was the reality of drinking. I removed the nonsense, the lie behind it, and replaced it with something I think was a lot more real. Because there were lots of times I drink and I didn't have a particularly good time. But every time I drank alcohol, I would wake up feeling rubbish. So for me, understanding those processes kind of turned it around. And it is possible, if you do that, to not crave. Because if the thought of an alcoholic drink enters your head, there's two ways it can go. It can either be, wow, wouldn't it be lovely if I had a drink, and aren't I unlucky because I can't have one, and maybe I could have one on just this one situation, blah, blah, blah. Or you can think to yourself, I finally knocked that on the head. I don't have to go through that ever again. God, didn't I hate waking up at 3-4 in the morning feeling awful, and I never have to experience that again because I don't have to drink that filthy muck anymore. And if you can use that as your thought process, you won't be craving because you're not taken up in that, I wish I could do this.
Yeah, so you can kind of change the story, because usually when we have something we're about to do, we're looking at one tiny sliver of the reality. And with drinking, we easily get caught into this sort of dopamine excitement, like, ooh, and that just wanting it and looking at it and thinking about it alone gets you all excited and basically pushes you toward the alcohol. But we could go the other direction. We're not only motivated by sort of pleasure and excitement, we're also, you know, we can motivate ourselves by looking at something we fear or that's very, very painful or something we hate. Mm-hmm. We can use these sort of negative emotions to drive us in there, like you're saying. And it also reminds me of, you wrote about this fading affect bias, which is just a term for a certain psychological bias. Can you talk about that and how people can use knowledge of this fading affect bias to help them in times of craving or when they want to quit drinking, for example?
Yeah, absolutely. So fading affect bias is a recognized psychological process. And essentially what it means is that humans tend to look back on past events more positively than they were when they actually experienced them. It's kind of the embodiment of nostalgia, looking back on the past, thinking everything was perfect, when of course it wasn't. Now, the interesting thing about fading affect bias is it's universal. So everybody on the planet exhibits it. It's not just, you know, specifically people in the West that show it or whatever. It is a universal human trait. It's built into our genes. There's a lot of theories about why it exists. And I think the predominant one is it just helps you maintain a more positive outlook on life because you look back on the past and you think, oh yeah, it was all good, even though maybe it wasn't. But be that as it may, I think you just need to bear in mind when you look back on past events, you tend to forget the bad and concentrate on the very good parts of it. And people, you know, that may work well for us in certain situations, but it definitely doesn't when it comes to drug addiction. And I include drinking alcohol very much in that category because, you know, think about drinking. Even best case, you're going out for a few hours of the evening, and I've explained why this isn't the case, but let's assume you think that you're actually having a better night because you're drinking for what, 4 or 5 hours, but then you're demolishing your sleep, you're feeling rubbish all the next day. Even on a very basic level, looking at the whole picture of a 24-hour drinking session, you've got 5 hours of enjoyment followed by 20-odd hours of feeling tired and anxious and sick and miserable. But when you think about drinking in your past, you don't remember the hangovers. You think about how good it was being out with your mates, having a few beers, and wasn't it great fun? So this is the thing, and it very much feeds into craving. When you've stopped drinking and you think, oh, alcohol drinking, you'll be filled with all these great memories of how wonderful it was, and you start to forget the bad. And you need to make a conscious effort. And again, I'm not talking to people about trying to convince yourself of something that's not true. Trying to get people to stick with the reality, even in the best case, you know, drinking is a fifth pleasure followed by 4/5 of unpleasantness. So it's not a particularly good deal anyway. But when you actually really get under the skin of it, even those 4 or 5 hours of pleasure are not genuine pleasure anyway, because if you go about it the right way, you can enjoy yourself more without the alcohol. So that's the fading effect bias thing. It's just to bear in mind, if you're just, I sometimes term it lazy thinking, but it's not really lazy. It's just natural thinking. It's just where our thoughts go. If you quit drinking and just sit back and let your thoughts wander, you will end up probably craving alcohol, because you'll be thinking, oh, I really enjoyed alcohol. It was such good fun. Fading effect bias kicking in. You're only remembering the good bits and not the bad. And then you start teasing yourself with the thought of it. Oh, I could have one. Wouldn't it, you know, surely I can have one. Wouldn't it be really nice to have a beer right now, or a glass of wine, or whatever? So you very quickly get into that obsessive phase of it. So for me, it's very much a question of keeping track with reality. You know, okay, let's assume I do have a beer now. How will it make me feel? Slightly dulled, and then it will wear off, giving a corresponding feeling of anxiety, which I either suffer or have another beer to get rid of it. And depending on how often I go through that process before I fall unconscious will dictate how awful I feel the next day. So I think that's a key thing for people. If they're looking to stop drinking, really try and stick with the reality rather than get sucked into these, you know, these fantasies about alcohol.
But we really do enjoy that quick spike of excitement and possibility and randomness, I think, the alcohol gives us. I think that's one thing we want to feel. Alcohol does, in the short term, supply us with all these happy chemicals of dopamine and serotonin and endorphins and all of these things. And when you stop drinking, you're just going to have to find these things somewhere else. So after you stopped drinking, did you find, well, surely you did, what new sources of pleasure and happiness and connection and all of these things did you discover?
So I've always exercised anyway. I was in the army for a few years, so I always carried on my exercising from there. And in fact, most of the time, the reason I didn't exercise is because I was either drinking or hungover. So I carried on exercising, and that gives you a massive endorphin hit. Exercising, it just makes you feel good all day. And when you're physically fit, you feel mentally more resilient as well. It really feeds into itself, but a lot of people don't appreciate. But when human beings are feeling, in fact, not just human beings, all animals, when you're feeling unwell, you want to hide away and recover. You know, it's just nature's way. You know, if an animal's injured, it doesn't want to be out fighting and finding a mate and hunting and all the rest of it. It just wants to lie down, hide away and rest, give its body a chance to repair. But equally, when we feel fit and healthy, we feel much more resilient, much more adventurous. So there's this massive correlation between the two. If you stop drinking and do a bit of exercise, you will feel far better than you ever did when you were drinking anyway. And I think it's probably also worth mentioning as well, although you're talking about, you know, this massive endorphin hit when you get drinking and all these possibilities, I would say again, sit on your own in a room with no music, no friends, no nothing, and have a drink. And I guarantee you won't get that massive hit. You won't be there thinking, oh, wow, this is fantastic. This is really good, because it isn't. Most of the time, what you're talking about is that endorphin hit you get when you're doing something exciting, when you're with your mates, whatever. And alcohol may have taken off that slight edge of nervousness that was stopping you from getting that endorphin hit. so you link it all together. But actually, had you not drunk alcohol and just persevered for another half hour until you relaxed into the event anyway, you would have probably felt much the same without the alcohol.
Right, because either through social anxiety or something we're scared of or laziness or whatever, we don't leave our house sometimes. We don't even go to the event. And if we go to the event, well, we're just less likely to go to events or even to leave our house because we have all these rational excuses, these stories we tell ourselves, or maybe we have some kind of actual anxiety or whatever. But it sounds like what you're saying is just find some way to kind of push yourself through the door and just sit there in that weirdness for, you know, 10, 15 minutes or whatever. And then basically you're off to the races.
Yeah, you should be. Yeah. So this is my own personal story. As I say, when I stopped, I was stopping with the mindset that I'm not going to enjoy social events anymore. So after stopping drinking, if there was a social event, I would just not go to it. I just didn't want to. Work events, home events, whatever, I was not interested because I was like, I'm not going to enjoy it without alcohol. I don't want to sit there and feel uncomfortable for 4 hours. But you can't avoid everything. Well, I couldn't anyway. There were events that would come up, like a family member's special birthday or something at work I really couldn't get out with. And I was sort of forced into these things. So I was turning up thinking, this is going to be awful. I'll leave as soon as I can. But what I found was, as I say, you turn up, you're feeling pretty miserable, pretty awkward. You're determined not to enjoy yourself. But you'll probably end up talking to somebody at some point and you might find a topic of conversation you find interesting. And when you start to engage in that, all your attention starts to get taken up with that. And you start to forget the fact I can't have a drink. You start to forget the fact I don't want to be here. And you just become enmeshed completely in this social interaction. When you get into that situation, you'll start to get that endorphin rush and you'll start to enjoy yourself. And then you'll walk away thinking, oh my God, I actually did enjoy that without alcohol. And that's what happened to me. It took a few years, but I started to realize that actually I do enjoy social events. What I do now, and there's a lot more of them these days, is go to sober social events, you know, places where it's set up for people who don't drink, because then you haven't got... For me personally, and it may sound incredibly judgmental, and I apologize for it, and it probably is judgmental, but it's the truth. I don't like socializing with people who are drinking. I find when people are drinking, you've got maybe an hour or two of sensible conversation with them before they become unpleasant. I just don't like being around them, which is perfectly normal, because when you're socializing, you need a meeting of minds. You need to be on some kind of similar level. Now, if one of you is taking a drug and the other one isn't, you're not going to have that meeting of minds. You're not on the same level. It doesn't have to be alcohol. If you're talking to someone and they go off and sniff a load of cocaine or amphetamines and come back, they're going to be off and you won't be able to follow their thought process or anything. If you're taking the same drug as them, you'll be absolutely fine. But I think that's what people need to bear in mind. Unfortunately, we live in a very alcohol-centric society. 87% of people drink. Virtually all social events are centered around this drug. And when people are drinking, they start to repeat themselves. They start to step into your personal space. It's just not an enjoyable experience. So what I do is either concentrate on sober events, or if I do have to go to an event when there's alcohol, I leave when it starts to get what I would deem unpleasant. When people start to show the effects of the alcohol and it starts to get irritating, I leave.
Yeah, like unpleasant, irritating. These are gentle words. You could say obnoxious or just unbearable or whatever. Because I go, yeah. And I think this is what people who have never drank alcohol, they see very clearly. And if you ever go to an event and you're not drinking and you just like throw yourself into the worst of it, like go to a club at 1 a.m. or whatever and just sober, and you will be like, oh my God. So one, you're not really connecting with each other that deeply when you're drunk. And even if you do, like you mentioned, the memory systems aren't working, so you're not going to remember it. And even if you did in the moment, you're not getting the sleep, so those memories aren't getting encoded. Mm-hmm. This experience, it happens, but it sort of just disappears, and so do the people. So, but if you're not drunk, maybe you might actually make a friend or make a real relationship or something.
Exactly. Yeah.
You mentioned how we live in the society that is centered around alcohol. It seems like that changes through history. We have certain periods of 20 or 30 years or decades or whatever, where it kind of goes in and out of fashion. But the UK seems to be where, and this is where you are, it seems to have been pretty popular for a long, long time. And this is a question that's not maybe your expertise, but it's maybe from your experience, you're there. And the UK isn't the only country. There are a lot of other highly, I would say, kind of alcoholic countries. But what is it about your country or other highly alcohol using countries? Why do people from the UK love drinking so much?
I don't know. They do love drinking a lot. Yeah,
I feel like that. You know, I can go meet my American friends even, and it sometimes like yeah. But like during certain events, for example, like it's the last day of work or it's the first day of going back to work or different things, it's almost like this compulsion to. They feel weird almost if they don't drink, and I'm like, whoa, why do we got to drink? So I think it might be particularly embedded into the culture in certain cultures. I'm not just saying the UK, but I haven't really studied this so much, and it's a kind of a question that you're probably not prepared for. But maybe this is a comment. But if you have any comments about that, then we can go there.
Yeah. No. It's the UK is. I've been to the US a few times, and I think. There are differences in how we drink, but I think the UK, there's a slightly different view of problem drinking in the UK, which differs, I think, to the US. In the UK, people kind of think as long as you're only drinking in the evening, it's fine. And, you know, I know people who drink a lot in the evening, 2-3 bottles of wine, the equivalent amount of beer or spirits every night, and it's absolutely fine. Where I get the impression in the US that might be sort of frowned on a bit more. But there's a lot of events, and I think it's the same over there. So I was at the football, so soccer yesterday. So it was Fulham Chelsea, which is like a local derby and always quite a big match. And it was just carnage. It was like absolute chaos. But it's what people do. It's like you go out and you drink as much as you possibly can and go and have a punch up at the football. And it's just kind of almost like accepted. Yeah, so it just seems to be really deeply embedded in our culture. And of course, we have like pubs as well. So when you go into like places, you know, there's buildings that have been there for hundreds of years, hardly changed inside. They're really like they're amazing going. I still really enjoy going into pubs but drinking alcohol-free beer because they're just some of them are absolutely fascinating places. But it's a real center for people. You know, you very rarely meet people for a coffee or a meal. You meet in the pub. And you know, it is literally for a lot of communities, it's the center of their community. So you get little villages. And it's the pub where they all go to. It's where they meet and socialize. And without that, they don't have that social interaction. So it is just really deeply embedded in our culture.
Yeah, but this goes back to what you were talking about earlier of how we mix up the social experience with the drug experience. If you go to non-drinking cultures, for example, I've been to Pakistan a couple times, and there, of course, they don't drink. But they're still out on Friday, Saturday nights. Yeah. What are they doing? They're the cafes and other places are the pop-in places. Everyone just Starbucks is a place to be or whatever, you know? And maybe that's another drug, I guess, perhaps. But I mean, if that wasn't there, they would sit in the park and just like have a little picnic on the grass eating who knows what, you know? So we find our ways to be happy. We don't, but certain cultures kind of, they're more centered around alcohol.
I think that's right. So I went, and this was 15, 20 years ago before the current problems, but I went to Iran and it's the same, you know, they don't drink out there. And this is what I quite often say to people in our society, US and UK, we're so alcocentric. We kind of then think, how can I do any of these things without alcohol? But just very rough figures, there's 8 billion people on the planet, right? Approximately half of them don't drink alcohol. And, you know, like Iran, Pakistan, countries where for religious reasons they don't drink. There's a lot of cultures as well. It's not religious, it's just cultural. They just don't drink alcohol. You know, a lot of countries as well, people are poor, they can't afford it. But approximately half the people on the planet don't drink alcohol. They enjoy themselves. They go out and they have fun. And this is what I was talking about before when people say, oh, I've had, you know, I have to stop drinking, but I had some really good times on alcohol. These 8 billion people had good times. They just had it without the alcohol. it's not a necessary part of our existence.
And this next question is kind of a curiosity question. I can easily find the actual answer by doing this, but I don't want to do this. I don't not want to know fully what it's like, because it's just not worth it. It's just going to be a dangerous path. A lot of people, when they drink alcohol, or some people, when they drink alcohol, they also tend to smoke, to intake nicotine. And sometimes people even, there are people who even, they say they don't smoke, but they smoke when they're drinking. And it seems like the two are kind of connected together. What is it even like to drink alcohol and smoke a cigarette at the same time? Why is it such a popular combo?
It's an interesting one, and it's not just nicotine. People are far more likely to take like cocaine or other drugs when they're on alcohol. And I know of a lot of people who would take cocaine, but only when they were drinking. But this is the interesting thing with alcohol. I've talked about the dynamic, how it's a typical drug in that it gives you something, but then it wears off, leaving an unpleasant feeling. And the quickest way to get rid of that unpleasant feeling is to have another dose of the drug. It's withdrawal. It causes an unpleasant feeling that is the result of a chemical imbalance that is itself the result of the previous dose of the drug wearing off. And that's just typical chemical addiction. As the drug wears off, it leaves an unpleasant feeling, another dose to get rid of it. The problem is with alcohol, we consume it by drinking it. So we have it in a drink with a load of sugar and whatever else is in it. Now, you may go out and drink 5 pints of lager quite happily, but if you sat down and tried to drink 5 pints of Coca-Cola or even 5 pints of water, it would make you feel really sick. Okay, we are not designed to drink that amount of liquid. So what we find is there's a tug of war going on when we're drinking alcohol. Part of us wants more of the drug, but another part of our body is saying, I can't face any more of this sugar and liquid. It's too much. Drinking too much liquid is incredibly bad for you. It washes all the salt out for you. It can actually kill you. So you shouldn't be doing it. And as I say, imagine sitting down trying to drink 5 pints of water. It would make you feel really sick. So there's this tension going on. And the other thing, you know, I've already discussed about how alcohol is an appetite stimulant. So quite often when you're drinking, you want to eat. But the problem is, having eaten, when you drink alcohol, your stomach's full. So when you're drinking on a full stomach, it doesn't have the same effect. So the alcohol's wearing off, leaving this unpleasant feeling. And as the evening goes on, it becomes increasingly difficult to take more of this drug because it makes you feel sick. You might have eaten something, so it's not kicking in quick enough. So it becomes incredibly attractive to want to take another drug to change how you feel. Now, nicotine is a stimulant, as is cocaine. So you have this weird dynamic where people go out and drink for the first part of the evening and get drunk, and then they take cocaine or nicotine, and it almost like sobers them up because it's a stimulant. And it's this weird dynamic where they go out and they do all these drugs and they kind of cancel each other out, and they end up feeling almost as if they'd not had anything in the first place. And you think, well, why did you just not have any cocaine and any alcohol? And you'd have ended up feeling much the same as you do now. But this is the other thing with nicotine as well. It's, you start to feel groggy, you start to feel out of sorts, you can't really drink more, but you can have a cigarette and it makes you feel better. Now, turning the picture around as well, smoking, you get the drug, the nicotine, which is a stimulant, but it's actually an unpleasant way of doing it because you're having to inhale this smoke into your lungs, which is not a pleasant feeling. And of course, when you're smoking a lot, your lungs start to feel tight. It's not nice. Alcohol being a sedative will take the edge off that. So it's almost like you get to take the drug and not feel the unpleasant feeling with the smoke as it builds up and starts to make your lungs start to feel sore and unpleasant. So you're kind of allowing but the two drugs together allow you to take more of each of them. And if people, for example, they smoke only when they're drinking, what they'll find is they wake up the next day and their lungs feel really tight and really unpleasant. But they didn't feel tight and unpleasant the night before. And actually, if you think about it, that doesn't make any sense. They should feel worse the night before because that's when they've been smoking and they've had a few hours respite before they wake up the next day. But the reason for that is that anesthetizing effect.
Did you quit smoking and drinking at the same time? That seems like that'd be too hard of a task, I think.
Yeah. No, I quit smoking years before I quit drinking. Yeah. Yeah.
was the process kind of, I know we're talking about alcohol here, but if we can use these principles we're talking about and sort of spread them across all kinds of addictions, it'd be even more useful. What were some of the differences maybe between the two, the quitting process?
So there's a few differences and a few similarities. The differences with nicotine is, certainly for me anyway, I smoked all day every day. So I'd wake up and smoke cigarettes and I smoke throughout the day, which I didn't until my later drinking years do that with alcohol. So it was a very different process. And I think it is slightly different because I'm not talking now about people who only smoke when they're drinking, but when you smoke regularly, you quite quickly get to the mindset of feeling like it feels like you're doing it to feel normal. So you kind of think, if I can go long enough without it, I think I can go the rest of my life without smoking. Whereas with alcohol, there's a very different dynamic because people can stop for years and years, but still believe that alcohol is the icing on the top of the cake for parties, Christmases, weddings, vacations, whatever.
Right. And unless you're in some really special community or you have a certain workplace, generally social life isn't so tied up to smoking as it is with alcohol.
No, exactly. So a lot of the principles are the same. Now, although nicotine is a stimulant, it's still a similar physiological dynamic in that it wears off, leaving you feel just not right and not good. And you have that dose of nicotine and it makes you feel very alert, very focused, much better. But you never feel better than had you never had that dose in the first place. And of course, you know, I talked about the craving cycle. That applies equally amongst everything. So you will sit there and crave cigarettes or dip or, you know, vape or whatever it is in exactly the same psychological way that you will crave alcohol.
Yeah. And a lot of people listening, well, some people listening probably are like, enough of this anti-alcohol rant. I'm still going to drink and they're going to decide to keep drinking. But still, what kinds of things can people who do decide to keep drinking do to sort of minimize the effects, minimize the hangover, that kind of thing? I know you mentioned sodium, and so electrolytes is one thing, maybe getting some electrolytes in before or after drinking. What are some other things we can do to minimize the damage, if that's possible?
To be honest, the only thing you can do is to drink as little as you can get away with, because that's simply how it works. You know, you're talking about the electrolytes and stuff, that will assist with dehydration, but there's nothing that will assist with the anxiety, that anxious feeling you get when the chemical effect of alcohol wears off. There are ways you can get rid of that anxiety. You can go and take a prescribed drug, or you can take some heroin or something. Any kind of powerful sedative will get rid of it. But again, it's not necessarily a path you'd want to be going down. So for me, it would always be to drink as little as possible. But in my experience, even one or two, it's not that if I drink 10 drinks, I feel 10 points of badness. If I feel one drink, I feel one point of badness. And if I drink none, I'm just zero, no badness. It doesn't work that way, because even one drink will interrupt your natural sleeping pattern and leave you wiped out and tired the next day. So it's not like you can say, I'll have just one and I'll be all right, because you might not feel as awful as if you'd had 10 or a dozen, but it's nowhere near as good as if you hadn't had any. Do you see what I mean? So,
yeah.
And the problem is with saying, I'll drink less, like I said, one alcoholic drink wears off, leaving the desire for the next one. Okay. So we're not talking about a burger. I fancy a burger. I'm hungry. I'll eat a burger. Okay. You might have two or three burgers, but eventually you've had so many burgers, you don't want another one. That's never the case with a drug, because the drug will always wear off, leaving the desire for the next one. So what people often think about when they think of moderating, they have this ideal where I'll go out, I'll have a couple of drinks, it will make me feel really good, and I'll just get in the habit of drinking that, I won't want another one. So they have this idea that moderation will be all good. So you have your drinks, you have your relaxation, and you're good for the rest of the time. The majority of people, when they try and moderate, that's not the reality. What they're doing is looking at their watch. Can I have a drink? Yes, I can have one. It goes far too quickly. God, I want another one, but I can't have it, and obsessing. And you spend so much time trying to moderate and making it work, you're almost like you're wasting as much time as if you were just drinking loads. Okay, you might cut down on some of the negative parts of it, but for me, the best option is always to learn to live alcohol free, which we all did before we started drinking, all of us. You know, nobody is born drinking alcohol, but until we start drinking, we live perfectly fine lives, perfectly happy. You know, they might not be perfect, but we generally get on with them. It's only when we introduce it that we find we can't deal with it anymore.
Right. I'd like to say that I sort of choose to drink the first drink. Maybe the second drink. And even that might be a stretch because that's sort of controlled by the previous days of drinking. I'm sort of stuck in this non-autonomous loop. I don't have my free will anymore. Mm. But then the second drink, the third drink, it just starts drinking itself.
Mm. Yeah, you're right.
You can kind of stop it. It seems like it's drinking itself. You're just stuck in that loop. And that's on the micro scale of that night. But even if you zoom out to the month or the year, even when you're drinking and when you're not drinking, you feel less free. You feel less autonomy, less in control of yourself. So it also sounds like that's one of the big breakthroughs and things that you got out of this too, is you became more free.
It's freedom.
More in control of your life.
Exactly. Yeah, it's freedom. It's not. See, this is the thing. I think for me, I spend an awful lot of time thinking about alcohol. Okay. But I spend zero time thinking about whether to have a drink or not. Okay, because I decided 10 years ago in February, it was that 2014, I stopped drinking. I was never going to drink again. Okay, so that decision is done. If I was moderating, I'd be going through that thought process, should I, shouldn't I, can I, can't I, every day, every week, whatever, just with that. And it's exhausting, just that, you know, having to have a drink all the time or not have one, I can have one, I can't have one. It is easier just to, I'm done with it. I'm not having a drink. That's me done. And I'm perfectly happy with that decision. And oh, isn't it great? Because actually I found out that life was much better without it anyway. Yes, there's that period of days, weeks, even a month where you feel rubbish and a drink would make you feel better. But when you come out the other side of that, there's no contest. And we talked again, you know, we talked about how do you get through those first few days, weeks, months, whatever? To a degree, there's a big chunk of just teeth gritting and getting on with it. You know, you will want to drink in the knowledge that if you had a drink, you would feel a lot better. I'm going to be upfront with you. You would. If you're coming out with a shocking hangover, a couple of drinks will make you feel better, but they only make you feel better in the short term before making everything worse. Whereas if you can just get those few crucial days under your belt, you start to get a bit of traction. It starts to build up momentum. You start to feel better and you start to think, you know what, I can do this.
In this sense, maybe our definition of addiction needs to be a bit wider, because it seems like alcohol and addiction are just so tied up. And many people say, I'm not addicted, I just drink. And now the more we talk about this, it almost sounds like it's hard not to kind of be addicted to that. Because if you listen to like Andrew Huberman, his definition of addiction is a narrowing of things that bring you pleasure. And I guess alcohol would be this thing that is able to give you that level of pleasure and the possibilities of, well, not just pleasure, but meaning and all of these other good things in life. It gets narrowed and narrowed down. So you can still feel good and still feel pleasure, but through this limited range of possibilities. But when you stop drinking, that range of options or possibilities for happiness and connection and pleasure and all these other things, it widens up. So you don't need the alcohol, but you can engage and actually perceive other possibilities for yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Go back to the vacation example, is a classic one. So I go on vacation now. I enjoy the food. I enjoy sitting around by the pool. I enjoy going out for walks and exploring the local area. I enjoy all of that at face value. When I was drinking, I wouldn't have been able to do anything like that if I didn't have a couple of drinks first. And again, I emphasize a lot of that, you know, part of it would have been because I was drinking the night before, I'd been anxious and tired and the alcohol will take the edge off that. But a big part of it was the craving process, because I would be there thinking, oh, I want to drink, I want to drink, I want to drink. I don't want to go for a walk unless I've had a couple of drinks first. And so I wouldn't be enjoying it. So I think that's exactly right. Addiction, that one drug is the gateway to enjoying everything else. We sometimes think of it as, you know, it's having a drink's the icing on the cake. what we're really saying is I can't quite enjoy it without that. And I think you're right. We need to open up our understanding of addiction because, you know, if I say to a room full of people, hands up here, who is psychologically, if not physically, addicted to a drug to such an extent you can no longer enjoy or cope with life without it, no one puts their hands up, right? But if I say to the same room of people, hands up, who thinks it's more fun going out with your mates if you've had a few drinks, everyone puts their hands up. It's the same question, okay? Those people who are saying, I have more fun when I'm out with my mates with a drink, is exactly the same as saying, I don't have as much fun with my friends unless I have a drink, which is the same as saying, I need alcohol, I need a drug in order to fully enjoy this part of my life. Now, we quite often think of addiction as needing a drug all day, every day. Okay, I think we should change that definition and just say to ourselves, do I need a drug in order to cope with and or fully enjoy certain situations? Because if the answer is yes, there is an element of addiction there, albeit psychological rather than physical. But that's what 90% of drinkers are like. If you say to a drinker, there's a party tonight, would you rather go and drink or not drink? They'll say, I'd rather go and drink. Yeah. Why? Because they can no longer fully enjoy that event without alcohol, without a drug. So there's an element there of needing it, of being dependent on it.
Yeah, and if you replaced all the alcohol in their hand with a needle of heroin, you'd be like, this is clearly addiction. You guys clearly have problems. Mm. Or if it was like just lines of cocaine they're doing every weekend, you'd be like, you're probably addicted. But because alcohol is so socially acceptable, we kind of give it more breathing room. Like, well, maybe they're not addicted because it's alcohol. Maybe they're not addicted because it's caffeine. It's normal. But it's just because it's normal, really. Yeah. It seems.
It's normalized, exactly. Yeah. When you've got a majority of people doing it, it's excusable. It's normal. It's fine because everyone else is doing it.
And when you escaped that kind of addictive loop and you started to venture into these new possibilities, not only were you able to enjoy the moments more, swimming in the pool or having a real vacation, not just being drunk and forgetting the whole vacation, it also led you into actually creating things. You wrote these books, Alcohol Explained, Alcohol Explained 2, Nicotine Explained, and there's probably more. That would have never happened. And how great is that, that you probably wanted to be an author, you know, back when you were younger too, or maybe you didn't, maybe you just had to get this out. But that's cool too, the long-term benefits of things you can create, jobs you can have, relationships you can create. All of these things just are less and less likely if you're drunk. So what were some of the long-term benefits of stopping drinking? One is, you wrote some books and you have a new kind of slightly different kind of life. You're still a lawyer, which is a good thing. Or maybe not, depending on what you want. I don't know, but it's not a bad thing. I think a lot of people would take your job. What are some of the long-term benefits? And are there any, and maybe there are some downsides too, but I'm guessing not too many.
No, I think so. The biggest benefit for me was, like I say, when I was drinking, when I was hungover, I felt rubbish. A few days later, I'd feel okay. And for me, that okay feeling was me feeling the best I could ever feel. One of the biggest benefits was realizing that I was probably working from just existing from like 25% to 50% of my capacity. And because I've been doing it so long, 50% felt normal. But when I stopped drinking after a few weeks and then really started to build up, I realized it was 50% because I was getting back to 100%. And that 100% is how good you feel, how much energy you've got, just how much in control you are. And how resilient you feel, just, you know, the day-to-day stuff, just, I mean, sometimes it gets on top of me, but just so much less now that I'm not drinking. And that's what it comes down to for me. It was just this massively increased quality of life. And talking about, you know, writing the books and productivity, so much of my time was either drinking or recovering from drinking. And I might be doing stuff hungover, I might be in work, but I wasn't doing my best at stuff. And suddenly, you know, I've got evenings where I'm not drinking, where I not only can do stuff, but have the energy and motivation to do stuff. I wake up in the mornings feeling refreshed and ready to go, and I can do stuff then as well. And so quitting drinking as well, for me, it opened up so much more time to do stuff, just stuff that I like doing. You know, I've got a full-time job, I've got a young family, and I still find time to do all these other things. And it's not hard work for me. It's just I've got the time and energy to do it.
Yeah, more time, more energy, probably better relationships, probably doing better work in your day job as a lawyer. Probably finances are better. I'm guessing all of these things are all across the board better, and not just for you, but for probably most people who stop drinking, is my guess.
Yeah, I think if you stop drinking, you will be sleeping better. You'll be feeling more resilient. You'll be a better version of yourself. So, you know, you may or may not go on to be phenomenally successful, but you've got a far better chance. And for me, it's about reaching potential. Okay, you might become a world famous multi-billionaire, whatever, or you might not, but it's about doing your personal best. And you can't do your personal best if you're taking a drug that's ruining your sleep and mentally, you know, messing with your physiology, your mental chemistry, leaving you feeling anxious and wiped out all the time.
Yeah, because you're redirecting all that time and energy into the things that matter to you. Now you can actually see more clearly too. Maybe you didn't even realize they mattered to you, but now that the alcohol isn't dangling in front of you every day, you can look around and see, oh crap, this is me, let's go. And you got triple energy, triple time, all of that stuff. If people want to connect with you, I think obviously they can just type your name into Amazon, William Porter, they'll find your books. There's a website, is alcoholexplained.com, or where's the website, or how do we connect?
Alcoholexplained.com is probably the best place to start. And the original Alcohol Explained book, the first five chapters are a PDF on the website. So you don't have to give an email address or anything. You literally just click on a link and the first five chapters are there. So if people are interested, they can go there and have a look at that. And there's quite a few, they're called articles, but they're basically blog posts. And, you know, they're short little articles about all aspects of addiction and drinking, really. It's all on there. And then there's links to Instagram and Facebook and all the rest of it.
What are the, I know your book has a bunch of different chapters on different parts. What are the first five chapters? I think one is physiology.
Yeah. So the first chapter is just the introduction. Then there's the physiology, which we've talked about here.
Yeah.
The next chapter is the subconscious, which is something we haven't talked about, but that's a major part of addiction. So that's quite interesting. The part after that, I think, is craving, which we've spoken briefly about here. And then the next chapter is, I believe, the relaxation versus intoxication effect, where I talk about how those two things don't run their course at different times. So they're the first five chapters that are on the website.
Right. And then you've got Nicotine Explained at that book. And I guess the two main books are Alcohol Explained and Nicotine Explained.
Yeah, there's Diet and Fitness Explained as well, which takes a similar kind of common sense approach to. It's not so much diet, but I wanted to do a deep dive on what we eat and why, because it always bugged me that it seemed to me that we were like genetically made up to enjoy food that was bad for us. And I'm like, why have we evolved or been created to want to eat chocolate and bacon and all pizzas and all the stuff that's bad for us and makes us fat? So I wanted to do a real deep dive and understand what was going on there. And try and get under the skin of like hunger and appetite and food cravings and all the rest of it. So it was sort of that was triggering that one. So, but yeah.
I'm notoriously bad at trying to end the conversation. And after all the contact stuff, I ask a couple more.
Again, yeah.
But I'm really, really going to stop in a second. But I'm like, ugh. Because I like writing too. I like writing. Did you find that one of the books was easier to write or more pleasurable to write, or you enjoyed writing more than the others? And, did you become a better writer along the way? Do you feel like?
Yeah. I think so. I think my writing's kind of got better as I've written more books. I found Alcohol Explained incredibly hard to write, and I gave up halfway through and nearly didn't write it, but ended up going back to it. The reason I found it so hard is because I've broken it down into each constituent part. This is what's happening in your physiological. This is what's happening in your brain chemistry. This is what's happening with the craving, the subconscious, or this. And I've broken it all down. But of course, when we experience it all together. It's just this big thing that all happens at the same time. So it's really hard breaking it down into different parts and dealing with it chronologically, because you want to talk about one part, but it's influenced by another part, which you haven't. So it just became really messy and complicated. So as I say, I gave up with it in the end. But when I went back to it, I really enjoyed writing it. I think all my books, I've really enjoyed writing them, and I've been writing them. Yeah.
Did you? Okay, now I gotta go. This is last weird question. Okay, you're like, dude, get out of here. I'm never talking to you again. You're done. Did you always like writing, or was that something like more of like a tool you had to use to get the message out, or did you have sort of a, did you always want to write?
I haven't ever wanted to write. I never thought of myself as a writer, really. And in fact, even after I published Alcohol Explained and it had done very well, I still didn't think of myself as a writer. I almost thought of myself as someone who's got ideas that can be helpful for people, and I just commit them to writing. I suppose my job as a lawyer, I have done a lot of writing, because you're trying to convince people why what you're saying is right, or trying to steer them towards different things. The other thing I did in my job, I was always having to report on stuff. So, you know, I work in insurance. So what would happen is you get a claim in for millions and millions of dollars, and you'd have to seek authority internally from someone to pay that. So you'd have minutes with this person to try and explain why they have to write a check for $10 million or something. So I became very good at cutting through to the few. You know, you might have hundreds of pages of reports, but actually you might have four or five lines that are the key parts of it. So it kind of refined me to be very good at going through lots and lots of complicated information and taking out the basics that people need to understand to get their head around the whole concept. And I think really that was the skill that unwittingly I honed particularly well when writing Alcohol Explained, because there's an awful lot about addiction and alcohol dependency out there. And for me, it was about extracting what I thought was the key parts to make it all work. So I never really wanted to be a writer. I didn't think of myself as a writer. It was just trying to get information out there, really.
Well, now you're a writer, and you can't get around. You can't get around, because if you type in, I remember I first discovered you by just going into Google maybe 5 years ago, a while ago, and just having alcohol book, and first thing that popped up was your book. And if you type it in, if you type it in now, yeah, it's the same story. If you type in alcohol book or alcohol whatever, your book is there. So you're a writer. Google says you're a writer. The internet, the world says you are. Of course you are. What am I doing? But I thank you for that book. We needed it. And thank you for this conversation.
My pleasure.
If people want to learn more, they can go to your website, alcoholexplained.com. Thank you so much. And
thank you for inviting me.
Whenever I want to stop the craving to drink, I'll just
give me a shout.
Pop in this episode.
Yeah.
Or I'll message you.
Yeah.
Save me, William. What do I do? No, I'm kidding. Then you block me. Okay. All right. Thanks.
Fantastic. Thanks a lot. Take care. Bye.